Keeping up with South Korea's fast-paced developments just got easier. Welcome to the Korea Pro podcast, your weekly briefing on the stories that matter. Hosts Jongmin Kim and John Lee dissect topics from diplomacy to technology, ensuring you're always informed. Our episodes are a must for professionals in and out of Seoul. Subscribe on your preferred platform and elevate your understanding of Korean affairs. Korea Pro Podcast, where clarity meets depth. Listeners, and welcome to the NK News Podcast. I'm your host, Jacko Zwetslut, and today we are recording our monthly roundtable episode. It is Tuesday, March 12th, and I'm here with my colleagues, Jongmin Kim, Chatter Carroll, and Treyas Reddy. Welcome on the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We've got three themes to get through today. We've got the spring exercises, North Korean social media, and inter-Korean relations, and any other items of business that I may not have put on the agenda. Let's start then with the spring exercises, always a hot topic. Jongmin, you've been writing a lot of stories about this in the last week or so, so why don't you kick us off? We've got Freedom Shield, we've got Buddy Squadron training, North Korea's doing its own things. Where do you want to begin?
Well, let's start with what Freedom Shield is. Freedom Shield, we have Freedom Shield and then Ulchi Freedom Shield. Mm. Freedom Shield is the March one. And the August one is called Ulchi Freedom Shield because Ulchi is a South Korean government part and they merged it at some point.
Right.
So this one is a little bit smaller version than Ulchi Freedom Shield, but North Korea tends to respond very angrily to that, which we've seen in the past year, past week. The Freedom Shield this time, something peculiar I would say about this year's Freedom Shield is that, first of all, it's the first time the March one is publicly adding the UN command augmentees for a certain part of the drill, which will come this week probably. And compared
to augmentees meaning what?
The UNC member states will be doing a supporting role for certain parts of the drills that the US and South Korean allies
are
doing.
Right, I saw Australia, Canada, France, and the UK being mentioned in one of your reports.
Right, it's 11 member states being added.
Okay.
And another part is that compared to last year was already very big in terms of live fire and field training exercises.
Right.
But this time the field training exercise doubled from last year. Ooh. So it's 48 in total for 2 weeks. 48 field training exercises.
Field training exercise. Okay. And there is also a tabletop component happening this month. Is that under Freedom Shield or is that separate from?
So technically the March Freedom Shield is computer simulated exercise. Okay. But this time it means that there are more sideline field training exercises that come under the Freedom Shield training.
Okay. So it's a big one. Yeah.
One of the two biggest ones.
Now it's scheduled to run through
Thursday.
Okay. North Korea had its own military exercises in which it simulated attacking a South Korean guard post.
Well, there were multiple that Kim Jong-un led throughout the week. One was the attacking Seoul sort of simulation that he led, and another one was using the artilleries, am I right? The artillery drills that North Korean side did. Another part was the live fire drills that North Korean leader also led. And after that, South Korean side also did a sort of like a counter-response drill, which was probably planned, but mm-hmm. publicized afterwards, trying to show that South Korean Air Force is capable of, one, the bombing the long-range artillery bases, as in probably kill chain exercises or precision strike exercises.
Yeah.
And another part,
these
which
things are often hidden in tunnels or in mountains, aren't
exactly,
they?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So they were using something similar to bunker busters, but this time it was the launcher busters.
Wow.
And another part of that was, this is also new, drills against low altitude flying and maneuverable cruise missiles.
So to try to hit a missile in flight before it hits the target, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, for the cruise missiles, it was using air-to-air missiles. Mm-hmm. To intercept it from the air.
Right.
This was in headline for a year because North Korea, especially in the past few months, have been doing back-to-back cruise missile launches, especially the new ones like Hwasal.
Yeah.
And a lot of South Korean experts have raised this. They warn that cruise missiles are much more difficult than the conventional ballistic missiles, and also difficult.
Is that because they're at a low altitude?
Low altitude, and they maneuver.
And they maneuver, right.
If you're looking from the video, I'm doing this hand gesturing thing that they maneuver.
She's snaking her arm left and right, ladies and gentlemen.
So it's more difficult to track and intercept. So this last week, they practiced both detection part, joint detection part, and the interception part.
Wow. I guess they didn't release any data on how accurate they were with these tests.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, I'd be curious to
know. That is always the, that's where the rubber hits the road, isn't it? How often you can bring down these things.
But they did release videos. And same with North Korean state media. When someone releases video here, it means that it's the most important thing. And the thing that they released videos of were these two things, cruise missile interception, the actual boom video.
Oh, yes.
And then the launcher busting video.
Wait, so does that mean that South Korea, first of all, put up something to act the role of a North Korean cruise missile?
There were dummies.
Right, and then launched something against it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. They did not really publicize what they were using to play as the dummy role for the North Korean cruise missiles. But looking from the video, I felt like it looked like a drone. But yeah, unclear.
Because the thing with cruise missiles, and you're probably familiar with this, Shreyas, given your aeronautical engineering background.
It is rocket science, Shreyas.
They do tend to fly very low across the terrain and quite fast speeds.
Yeah.
And we know that with conventional ballistic missile defense, you know, it's not easy. It's like some people describe it like trying to shoot a bullet with a bullet.
Mm.
Cruise missiles definitely fly slower than ballistic missiles, but that low trajectory means A, it's hard to get radar signature on them.
Right.
And
they're flying literally under the radar.
Yeah, and we have a very mountainous terrain here that unless I would imagine you have air assets in the area flying that can fire down towards the cruise missiles when they're launched, it's going to be complicated, right?
And there could be, it's higher possibility of collateral damage if they're flying close because they're so low.
Yeah, right. And at the end of the day, I mean, it's not really a big distance. So that aspect that you mentioned about it being them being much harder to track, even if they're much slower, by the time you're kind of in a position to respond, to detect them and respond, they already pretty much would be in South Korean territory if they chose to fire.
So. Mm-hmm.
Sort
mm-hmm.
of like how South Korea responded to or failed to respond to drones.
Yeah. Right.
Now, what about the buddy squadron training?
That was the one that part of the thing that I mentioned, it was a joint aerial exercise. They did not really, the allies did not really publicize much of the details, but this is a regular one. It's called Sangmae Hunyeon in Korean, which means double... what's me?
It's either a hawk or a... it's kind of a bird of prey.
Hawk, I think.
Yeah, or
double hawk? Something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's a bird name. And it's been decades, I think, since the Allies started doing that. It's one of the more regular ones that they do multiple times throughout the year. But they sort of did it as a sideline this time.
Okay, now what about a B-52 bomber? Was that flown over or near the Korean Peninsula?
Well, that's an interesting thing. Last time, you know how the UN administration publicizes a lot of these U.S. strategic assets coming in?
Yeah.
That was one of the things when I went to the MND for the joint JCS and USFK briefing, it was one of the main things that the reporters kept asking, like, are there any U.S. strategic assets coming in? And they were being really cautious about answering any of that. And B-52, it did come nearby to do a drill right before FS Freedom Shield with the Japanese forces.
So not over the peninsula, but near the peninsula.
It was actually over, I think, the South China Sea, near the South China Sea, I think, and then the East Sea.
Okay.
/ Sea of Japan. And
So east and west of the peninsula.
Well, I'll have to check that again, but it was somewhere near territorial waters.
Yep.
And also, South Korean Air Force did not really reveal anything related to B-52 yet, nor any USS, you know, aircraft carriers coming in.
Ah.
So we might see that happening this time, this week sometime.
Now, North Korea each year, each spring, often gets very exercised about these exercises, to pardon the pun. And this time it made a statement, the frantic war drills by the rock puppets and vassal forces led by the US make a clear contrast with the reality of the DPRK, which is mobilizing large-scale military forces into economic construction for the promotion of its people's well-being.
Hmm.
That's just a portion of the statement. Is it my imagination or is North Korea less upset than it has been before and it's focusing on doing its own thing, which is sending out soldiers to build houses and stuff?
This is actually quite new to come from a defense ministry. That was a defense ministry, a North Korean defense ministry's first formal reaction to this week's Freedom, this year's Freedom Shield. Mm-hmm. People were imagining some sort of really angry statement about, you know, we will do a preemptive strike, like we saw last year, like preemptive strike if any U.S. strategic assets come in, something more provocative.
Certainly in the context of what we've seen since December 31st, I expected something like that.
Right, but experts were telling me that this was more toned down than they expected. And although we did see these statements about, oh, our soldiers are so busy helping, they didn't say busy, but we are mobilizing our soldiers to help with economic construction thing. We've seen that a lot of times before in economy-related articles or economy-related plenums. But for defense ministry to say this during Freedom Shield, to say that, you know, we are doing this responsible thing and you guys are using armed forces for something provocative.
Right.
There's a contrast. This sort of framing is quite novel.
Chad, it feels a bit like North Korea is taking the high moral ground here, isn't it? That, you know, you're wasting your resources while we're trying to build up the economy for the people.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of economic activity right now, lots of construction going on
in
rural areas.
So there is some
truth to it. At the same time, I don't think that's probably the main explanation. There are other factors to consider. One thing is that North Korea, I've noticed with exercises, often we have this exact conversation. The exercises are ongoing. North Korea seems quiet. And then
some people were saying, oh, North Korea is being so silent.
Yeah. And then lots of stuff happens in the weeks after. So
it happened 12 hours afterwards.
Yeah. That's one possibility. The other is that, and I know there's mixed views on this, one visitor from DC told me the other day that they suspected this is down to North Korea's large-scale provision of shells and munitions to Russia, that they're just not really in a position. I don't know if that's directly related. Ballistic missile launching, I mean, North Korea's been pretty quiet on that front for a while. The same visitor's thoughts was that all new missile production is going to Russia. I don't know how accurate that is.
But I've been hearing, I listen to a podcast, a really excellent one from The Telegraph every day called Ukraine the Daily. Mm-hmm. And what I'm hearing on that show is that a lot of the Russian soldiers are complaining that the stuff they're getting from North Korea is really bad. Like we're seeing barrels of artillery tubes being blown wide open like a flower bloom, basically because of the artillery shells not fitting properly or not exploding properly or exploding in the barrel instead of out of it. It's not good reports. I don't think they're sending their newest and best stuff.
I mean, so obviously it is something that it would be interesting to see how these missiles are actually performing, the missiles and artillery shells. But at the same time, I don't think North Korea will see it as a total loss, even if it's not working well. At the end of the day, for some of these weapons, particularly the newer missiles, the newer technology that they've developed in the last 5 years, this is the first time they're actually getting to test them in battle conditions. Yeah. So no matter what, they're getting data out of this. And
this is the KN-23/24. Yeah. It's one of North Korea's most, or two of North Korea's most sophisticated short-range ballistic missiles, solid fuel. The Ukrainian, they have cast, you know, publicly they've said only two military targets from 24 ballistic missiles have been on point, according to Ukraine's top prosecutor. That was mid-February. I don't know. Will that be an objective analysis of North Korean capability? Probably not. Mm-hmm. It may well be that those missiles are more reliable. I mean, when you look at the pictures that we've got out of state media on all their test launches over the last few years, I mean, we're seeing them being used to target very remote islands with pinpoint accuracy. Now, they may have more, you know, premium quality assured models being used in those demonstrations.
Yeah.
And it's possible that the ones sent to Ukraine, it was a bit of a rush job. But yeah, I think the jury's probably still out on the short range ballistic missiles. But yeah, with the artillery and shells and stuff, there's probably more substance to the criticism.
Hmm. Let's turn to our second theme here. And Shreyas, this is based on your work. You've done an excellent long form article for NK Pro, released on March 8th, called Status Update, Tracing the Ups and Downs of North Korea's Social Media Forays. And you take us through North Korea's entry into the world of social media back in the early 2010s, right up until its scrubbing now. So give us a quick summary version of the whole overview.
Well, essentially, North Korea came into this whole social media game fairly late compared to a lot of other countries. So 2010 was when it made its grand debut on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. So initially, it was very much aimed at spreading the messages of their existing external propaganda sites. Over time, other state media organs started kind of appearing, but there was certainly doubt on how legitimate these were, justifiably so. In all, for the most part, North Korea kept its social media strategy more focused on the messaging it wants to convey to the outside world rather than what it portrays domestically. And so it had a lot of different experiments, a lot of different platforms, a lot of different methods, ranging from official accounts to just individuals claiming to be independent of the state and portray their own views, but essentially controlled by state media. But over the last, at the start of this year...
Hang on, before you get onto that. Some of these accounts were in the English language,
yes.
And a lot of them were also in Chinese, right?
Yeah.
Do you know if they were also targeting other language groups? Was there Russian accounts and Arabic or Spanish accounts?
There were. So a lot of this came out of their South Korea-facing accounts, websites to begin with, the South Korea-facing services. So initially, most things were in the Korean language.
Mm.
But in the last few years, we started seeing them take to English language on service, the English language services like Twitter and YouTube, Chinese on Weibo and Youku, and on Russian sites as well. So Kontakt here, the main Russian social network. So they had a fair bit of variety, essentially mostly focusing on these languages, but the vast majority of their content was still in Korean.
Mm, okay. And so what happened at the start of this year?
Well, pretty much at the very end of December, North Korea at its ruling party plenum, well, Kim Jong-un specifically declared unification with South Korea to be an impossible goal and called for a decisive change in how North Korea deals with anything related to the South. Since then, we've seen them removing just about all traces of South Korea in terms of their engagement. So everything from changing their national anthem to removing a monument about unification. But some of the most visible changes have been in how they've shut down their South Korea-facing propaganda sites and the social media accounts. That shutdown suggests that it's not just South Korea. They are looking just beyond South Korea. They're in their external engagement strategy in general.
Have they killed all their social media accounts? I mean, what's left?
Pretty much all of it has been deleted. There are a handful of just leftover accounts, but these are ones that have been dormant for years to begin with. So it seems more likely that they just forgot to delete them.
Is it possible some of it might be down to the fact that it was like a game of whack-a-mole? Like they would put all this effort into building accounts and then providers like YouTube, Google, X would just delete them?
I mean, yeah, that's certainly something that in the last few years, they've possibly had diminishing returns in that sense. I mean, right from the start, they'd set up accounts, they'd get deleted. For example, Uriman Jokri, their propaganda website, it came on the scene first with a Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook account. The Facebook account was deleted almost immediately. Twitter and YouTube kind of came and went on and off over the years. But a lot of their accounts have had that problem in recent years. And I think at some point they must have also figured this isn't working. We need a new strategy. So if they're anyway going and removing everything else, why not?
Well, luckily they have KCNA Watch.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Provided by?
Provided by us.
Provided by us. That's right.
But so by KCNA you, our readers.
Now, what about sock puppet accounts like Cold Noodle Fan and other ones run by Sogwang Media? Are they all dormant now?
Sure. Well, just to explain to our listeners. So sock puppet accounts are essentially those accounts which I mentioned where they present themselves as real people or individuals unaffiliated with the North Korean state while spreading state propaganda. And inevitably, like further analysis kind of shows that there are clear links to the state in these cases. As you mentioned, they typically have links to the Sogwang Media Corporation, which is a Pyongyang-based firm.
Run by the wife of the current DPRK ambassador to the People's Republic of China.
Exactly. So very strong ties to the regime.
Yeah.
And so these accounts have, over the years, made a much bigger impact in some ways than some of the official state propaganda accounts. But they also kept getting deleted, kept getting deactivated, suspended, whatever.
Popping up with a new name.
Exactly. And Cold Noodle Fan was one of the most prominent of this this trend. So Cold Noodle Fan initially turned up, I think, around 2017, but started getting more attention from around 2019 onwards. Then the inevitable cycle of suspensions, returns, account terminations continued. Eventually, Cold Noodle Fan moved operations to Chinese platform Weibo, but and also adopted a new name. But
still gave the appearance of being a third party independent from North Korea, such as I got this photograph from my friend in Pyongyang, but it's really just the Seogwang Corporation.
Pretty much, okay. Yeah.
All right, so they moved to Weibo. Are they still there?
No. I mean, pretty much at this point, North Korea's gone scorched earth and everything. Everything's gone.
That's interesting. So, one other thing that I learned for the first time and belatedly, thanks to your excellent article, check it out on NK Pro, listeners. North Korea had its own short-lived domestic social network, StarCon, but it was domestic, but on the internet. So, explain that a little bit.
So, essentially, the working theory is that they accidentally made it live, and there's no proof of this, of course, but essentially, it suddenly got discovered in the wild by people outside the country.
This is some years ago, right?
This is 2016.
16, okay. And like a copy of Facebook?
Absolutely. So it looked very much like Facebook in its earlier years.
Right.
And yeah, so people outside discovered it. It did not take very long for hackers to break into the system, take control of it. And a bunch of people created accounts, including parody accounts of Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
So unsurprisingly, the site shut down after a few days.
So it was a very short-lived.
Yeah.
All right. Now, you wrote in your article that, quote, experts told NK News at the time that the shutdowns after offer Pyongyang a chance to revamp its external messaging strategy. Has there been any attempts to revamp the external messaging strategy yet? Are we seeing any developments on TikTok or anywhere else?
So it's still too early for now. I mean, they just shut down these things a couple of months ago, and it looks like they're still making a lot of other changes to anything related to their inter-Korean engagement, their external engagement. But we're at least they seem well-placed to be able to make a return at some stage. What form that return will take, it's hard to say right now. We're seeing all sorts of predictions. TikTok, you mentioned, is one of them. Maybe just gravitate to these short-form videos that, frankly, in this day and age, that are more popular than a lot of other platforms.
Right.
And at the same time, you know, the sock puppet approach, while they were prone to account suspensions and deletions, it still did make an impact while it was active. So they could always revisit that, but might have to just recalibrate their approach. And there are other tactics as well, of course. So the South Korea's intelligence has recently admitted, without any supporting evidence, that ahead of the upcoming parliamentary elections in South Korea, North Korea could turn to deep fakes on YouTube and other forms of,
could also land on the moon.
A
lot of these warnings are oftentimes, in my opinion, just very far-fetched.
Yeah.
Could do this, could do that. And yeah, North Korea could do that, but it actually doesn't have a track record of deep faking to a significant level using AI. I mean, there's been image alteration in the past, but...
So it's definitely not in the wheelhouse at the moment. Like, it's not something that they've particularly done. I personally have my doubts, but at the same time, if they do want to recalibrate the approach, they can at least revisit the option of using more modern tools and approaches, but that'll take time.
It looks to me, though, like the recalibration is a return to old style. Like, we saw in Kim Jong-un's early years, lots of economic and even political experiments, all of which he's turned his shoulder to and doubled down on the ways of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung.
Mm.
So I wonder if actually this is more about, we dabbled with these things. There were, I don't think they look at it in terms of page views and mentions and citations, rather like, what's the risk reward calculus? And what benefit did they really get during this time? I mean, I'd put that question to you. What benefit would they get strategically from all of these accounts?
To be honest, I'd say with most of them, it was a complete waste, especially the ones that were the official propaganda websites accounts, because all they were doing was just reposting articles or links to articles of what they had online. And it was the same tired old Cold War era style of writing and the same approach. And I think digital audience, online audiences, for the most part, are much more mature than North Korea was quite ready for.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think, and I think at some point they must have also realized, like you said, they're not really getting any reward on...
There might be articles about it, but when then you've got the risk of, you know, maybe something comes. I remember some of these videos with Cold Noodle Fan was posting of seemingly innocuous street scenes that looked totally normal and did portray to give a sort of inside background view. But then you would see things like them pixelating out people's shoes and bags, and that just totally undermines it and makes you think, what is going on? Like that this so-called independent blogger in North Korea has to block people's shoes. And just lastly on the NIS, I mean, I wondered if they're making these warnings. It seems to me they still didn't get the memo that Kim Jong-un is saying, we want nothing to do with you. So why would they want to interfere with the election?
Well, Jong-un?
Well, I'm planning to write about that question exactly. I see a lot of these habitual remarks about how North Korea will be trying to interfere with South Korean elections, presidential election or general election. But we have to, well, first, South Korean readers and listeners or whoever gets to see these North Korean propaganda or deepfakes or whatever, like you said, they're more mature than they were before. So first of all, it has very limited audience that will be actually swayed by these information tactics, first of all. And second, what will they get from this? Because North Koreans swore off engagement with both the left and right recently. Right. So they don't really care if DP wins. Or like, sure, they can have some fun messing with the people. PPP, the Conservative Party. But it does not mean that if Lee Jae-myung wins, like Lee Jae-myung's party wins, they will get something out of it.
Yeah.
And thirdly, we have to remind ourselves that this is also part of South Korean very easy propaganda. They can use this remark saying, oh, you have to be aware North Korea is trying to infiltrate our system and trying to sway our people's minds. If they start saying that and remind people that there are pro-North Koreans in this society, it gets really easy for the South Korean government to, you know, crack down on whatever opposition that sort of looks like, you know, socialist.
And if you are pro-North Korean in South Korea, what would you do now? Because haven't a lot of these NGOs disbanded already? Like,
yeah.
There's just
some of them have. Yeah.
The door has been shut to you.
Their name changed because they had to get rid of unification.
It is an awkward time.
In terms of, so just revisiting the whole idea of South Koreans being digitally mature and ready to handle misinformation. So I think on that front, I should also point out, so this is something we wrote about for Korea Pro as well last year, that a lot of research has shown that while South Koreans are quite digitally aware, quite mature, they're still quite susceptible to misinformation campaigns because essentially it's a very politically polarized society. So, but at the same time, people have already, for the most part, picked their camps. So they tend to gravitate towards misinformation and disinformation that aligns with the views they already have.
Exactly.
So it's not going to be about swaying opinions.
People probably already know who they're voting for.
Right. So on one hand, there is room for influence operations, but not to actually change people's minds.
Exactly.
To come back to the earlier what we were talking about, that North Korea may be starting a new TikTok and doing some different messaging and getting up to date there, I thought they might want to benchmark what Indonesia's Defense Minister Prabowo Subianto did in the lead up to the presidential election in February. He had a reputation as being a very harsh man, a strong man, and he totally revamped his image by doing silly dances on TikTok, and that helped him to win about 58% of the vote in the first round of the Indonesian election in February.
Well, so something tells me we won't be seeing Kim Jong-un doing TikTok dances or trends.
And on the flip side, Kate Middleton put out a picture the other day with her family, and it was seized upon very quickly by online communities that had been.
And a lot of news
edited,
agencies actually
removed it.
Yeah, removed them.
That led the BBC News, World News this morning at 8 a.m. On TV, I suppose.
Vital news.
We all need to know. Now, before we get on with our next topic, Chad at Jongmin, tell us a little bit about the Korea Pro dinner events that you've been having here lately in Seoul. The Korea Circus, I believe it's called?
Seoul Circus. Yeah, so basically we've done four or five of these events. Sadly, only really eligible if you live in Korea. We're not doing these internationally yet. But if you are coming into Seoul, check out events.koreapro.org. That's events.koreapro.org. And there's two formats, basically.
And look ahead of your travel schedule because these events are small. They sell out quickly.
More frequent.
If you know that you're coming next month, then go to events.koreapro.org to see if there's one coming while you're here and then sign up for it.
Yeah, for sure. So we've got two formats thus far. One is like a kind of like a dinner table, dinner party format, which is like 12 guests, nice meal, and a guest speaker. We have Eric John, the president of Boeing Korea, is the next speaker for that. And then we also have...
He's a former diplomat, right? He's got State Department gravitas as well as corporate experience, yeah.
Yeah, a very career-focused career. He also, we also have a second... Sorry, that was a terrible pun.
No, no, it's great. It's what brought me here to this country. You make Korea your career. Yeah, it's great.
And we also have... Do you want to explain the other format we've got, Jungmin?
The other format is that we find quirky restaurants in South Korea, in Seoul, so that we can take you to somewhere that you haven't been, aside from these hotel restaurants. And then we do like maybe Korean barbecue style, or, you know, more Korean food and more informal. And we just discuss things over beer or soju because it's an evening event.
And, or makgeolli, don't forget.
Yeah. And it's not a round table. We sit table by table and you get to make new friends. And we discuss pending issues. Like last time we discussed semiconductor related technology leaks to doctor strike and so on and so forth.
Yeah, because I think there's a certain cohort, maybe some of you, of our listeners will recognize themselves here, that fly to Korea regularly on business class, stay for 3 days and visit the Hyatt, the Choson or Four Seasons Hotel, meet the same circle of English speaking civil servants and experts from the Korea side and then go home. And guys and women, you're not learning anything new by doing this. Please, I highly recommend you get out of your bubble and take part in something a bit different.
And we're also leading a hike to
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
I've signed up for the March 21st dinner event, so I'll be there.
That's we've got Michelle Lee from Washington Post and Shin Boyong from Munhwa Ilbo. Yeah, so it's a great... So in this case, yeah, foreign correspondent and a local correspondent will be talking about what's on their radar. And yeah, it gives both people based in Seoul, opportunity to meet new people, and those visiting, like I said, a way to get out of the normal discussions, which sometimes personally I don't think necessitate 4 or 5 trips a year to indulge in.
But you got to get your points, your frequent flyer points. All right. Thanks for that, Chad. All right. Let's get on with our third and final theme, inter-Korean relations. So, Jongmin, Seoul's foreign ministry is dissolving its Korean Peninsula Peace Negotiation Headquarters, moving its bureaus to a new division, tentatively named the Diplomatic Strategy and Intelligence Headquarters. Tell us about that.
People who, State Department officials, would be very familiar with this name that's gone now, which is Hanbando Gyosop Bumbu, which is the Peace Negotiation Headquarters. This is a counterpart headquarters to someone like Steve Biegun in the past. This is what the Yonhap reports usually call nuclear envoy in South Korea.
Right.
It's not that that envoy role is gone, but that they're just moving to a new headquarters without a name that involves peace. Mm-hmm. So they're getting rid of peace in many of the departments and bureaus and headquarters. So this is in line with what the South Korean Yoon Suk-yeol administration has already done with the Unification Ministry, getting rid of inter-Korean relations-related stuff. And their justification is there's nothing going on. So we have to sort of align our departments and bureau names with what is actually going on and our new goals.
Do you, do you know, is there any, like, the logical progression of this is that all of these peace observatories along the border and peace zones should also be on the chopping block, right?
Yeah,
or
I think
called
so.
Security observation decks or...
So it's intelligence observation deck? I guess.
Yeah, just change the name. I mean, you don't close down a facility.
And they really love adding intelligence to names now. You know that Unification Ministries, one of their departments working on research when it comes to North Korean state media and stuff, they changed the name to intelligence as well. Changed back. It was like that during the previous
Park Geun-hye administration.
But this MOFA involving this diplomatic strategy and intelligence and their headquarters name is new.
Yeah.
But yeah, it changed.
So I presume that Director Om Tae-ho, who I interviewed on episode 287 of this podcast, may be moving to a different office or changing his desk, that little thing on your desk that says which department you're in.
I'm guessing only the banner will change. The same people will be doing mostly the same work,
okay.
But it's more like a reshuffle of these departments and bureaus. So this is this has become a 4-bureau, slightly bigger headquarters, and it seems like the goal is to... This was also one of the trends we saw in the past year under this administration. They're trying to put North Korea under something bigger. So not just North Korea, but just security in general, and North Korea is part of it.
So we've seen both Koreas in the last few months seriously overhauling their government bureaucracies in charge of inter-Korean relations and unification affairs. Is this something that there's a precedent for in the last 70 years since the signing of the Korean War Armistice, or do you see this as a whole new beast?
I think we've seen something similar in the past as well, just these logistical name changes of the departments. But still, the experts did point to the downside, the risks of doing so, is that when even the department name changes, their role and the goals slightly change.
Right.
And then when the diplomats and these public servants are rotating in a lot of times.
Sure.
And then when you don't get to train the next generation staffers on things like peace negotiation, it could lead to a problem when there are sudden negotiations that you really have to work on.
Right. So,
but it's not like it didn't happen before.
Okay, but don't stop talking about peace. Somebody's got to be on it.
And what happens if Trump starts talking about peace?
That's
and he
exactly
comes back?
What I'm talking about.
and that would be less than a year from now if it happens, right?
Could be a bit.
So they better not fire anybody yet.
Awkward, yeah. Now, still on the same theme there of inter-Korean relations, Lee Nak-yeon, who had been prime minister under President Moon, and he's now head of this new minor New Futures Party, which is, that's allied with the Democratic Party, right?
No, they hate the Democratic Party.
Oh, they hate Party. Oh, beg your pardon. Okay. So he's,
for more, read my analysis on KoreaPro.org.
Please, yes. or listen to the podcast.
Yes.
So he's made, Lee Nak-yeon has put out calls for the Yoon administration to seek a summit with North Korea. Is he reading the mood of the room correctly, or what's going on here?
Well, I think he would have struggled a little bit on what to do with this North Korea, inter-Korean engagement thing, because North Korea was like, oh, we don't want friends with you, be friends with you anymore.
Right.
But it seems like he's choosing, we'll just keep this relations like until you feel better. And then the most interesting part, I think, from that remark about asking Yoon to do a summit is he wanted Yoon to potentially tap previous President Moon Jae-in to play a certain role. I think there he's really, really not reading the room.
Bearded man of wisdom.
Because North Korea hates Moon Jae-in.
And right. To be fair, President Yoon had a very strong anti-Moon platform when he got elected as well.
Right.
This is not exactly an...
His fan.
There are still people agitating for President Yoon to, or at least for the prosecution, to launch criminal charges against former President Moon, right? So to now say, hey, we should tap him to be an intermediary between Seoul and Pyongyang.
Well, his logic is that the Japanese prime minister is working on trying to do a summit with North Korea and trying to de-escalate. And he was saying that we should do the same thing. And you know what? Moon was working on this for a long time. But we know from multiple testimonies with people involved at the time that North Korea, and also Kim Yo-jong's own statement, that North Korea felt very betrayed from how Moon intervened when it comes to expectation about the Hanoi summit.
Was Lee Nak-yeon himself directly involved in any of the previous summits?
He went to multiple summits as prime minister, yes.
Right. All right. So he ought to know better.
Yeah, and he was like, but he was suggesting that Kim Jong-un still has lingering feelings about some of the former leaders like Trump. So he was hinting that there might be some sort of possibility for a resumption of dialogue.
Is it just virtue signaling by Lee Nak-yeon 1 month ahead of the elections?
Yes.
Is that basically? Okay, so we can really...
Also, he's trying to name... he's trying to find ways to name drop Moon. And that's one of the only things that's left about the relevance of the previous administration, previous president, former president. And that by name dropping, he knows that Moon supporters will go for him.
And Moon supporters are not fans of Lee Jae-myung, the head of the Democratic Party.
And neither of Lee Nak-yeon right now, because Jo-guk created a new party and it's very, very popular right now.
Messy. Okay, this is next. I'm certainly going to be watching and listening to your Korea Pro podcast.
I'll be writing about it this week.
Because this election coming up next month will be messy. But back to, you just mentioned the Kishida, Japan-North Korea relations. What are we, any news on that? Is that going ahead? Is that looking likely?
Nope.
No. Here's the thing. Kishida has been bringing this up repeatedly since he became prime minister.
For domestic reasons.
Yeah, exactly. It's something that consistently Japanese prime ministers in general, but particularly Kishida, drawing a contrast between him and Abe, who was a little more conservative.
Right.
Kishida wants to keep bringing up the issue of the abduction of Japanese nationals in the 70s and 80s in particular. And every now and then he will propose, he will say, I am open to meeting Kim Jong-un without preconditions. And this is, at this point, a monthly thing, to be honest.
Okay.
It's just that the last couple of months, there's been a little more coverage of these statements, not just in Japan, but around the world. And then Kim Yo-jong responded to it as well. So people have started talking about it like, oh, this is something that's in the works. But Japan There were reports already since last year that Japan had kind of entered back channel negotiations, but there hasn't really been any
progress.
And
also the latest development was that Kim Yo-jong said something like, like man up and, you know, try to not keep talking about the abductee issue, which is all settled. And then Japanese government pushed back immediately saying, oh, we cannot agree with that.
Yeah. But just to remind you, though, March 26, Pan-North Korea football match in Pyongyang.
Yeah.
It's going ahead. Japanese Football Association
confirmed
it yesterday.
Yeah, so before this, there was an Olympic playoff between the women's teams. Now, that was supposed to take place in Pyongyang and Tokyo, the two legs.
Okay.
The Pyongyang one got postponed, supposedly, because the Japanese Football Association raised some complaints to the Asian Football Confederation about the logistics of it all.
Mm.
So, last week, the AFC sent a delegation to Pyongyang to inspect it. And as of today, the news appears to be that the match in Pyongyang is going ahead for the Men's World Cup qualifiers later this year.
And when South Korea had a match against North Korea, I think it was under the Park Geun-hye administration, ladies' match.
Yeah.
I seem to remember a birdie telling me that a certain cohort of fans on the South Korean side were actually Ministry of Unification staff.
Mm.
So maybe there's something like that might happen where Japanese
foreign...
I can
guess who your bird was, but okay.
Well, it should be interesting. But I think, if this goes ahead, and as of now, according to the football authorities in AFC and Japan, it is going ahead. This will be the first time foreign athletes will actually go to North Korea since... before the pandemic, and that's quite significant.
And there should be, I'd be curious to see what the ads and billboards are like at that match, because usually there for these kind of qualifiers, there are regulations to promote certain brands, right?
Yeah, and we've spoken to
which is a sanctions issue, potentially.
But, yeah, but we've spoken to experts in the past and said that they've said that essentially this is more about, you know, North Korea has to abide by these regulations. It's not about what North Korea is promoting, but essentially it's about their agreement with the organizers, whether it's FIFA, the AFC, or depending on the sport, it could be something else.
Just saying, I think, you know, from risk compliance background, if you see Adidas, Nike promoting their wares in Pyongyang and UN sanctions prohibit export of recreational sports equipment to North Korea, bit of a contradiction, no?
Let's see. Speaking of Japan-North Korea relations more broadly, though, I think that I'm wondering, since the death of Antonio Inoki a year or two ago, who was for a long time that sort of third-party, non-governmental go-between who would go back and forth, I wonder who's playing that role now? Who's sort of, you know, the North Korea-friendly or sympathetic Japanese person who does the sort of shuttle backdoor diplomacy?
I mean, I think the bigger challenge has been the pandemic over the last few years.
Sure.
But not because Japan, there are other lawmakers who have had that connection with North Korea who have interfaced, obviously not as high profile as Inoki, but they've certainly had that role. And there are back channel negotiations involving various groups, North Korea aligned, Japan aligned, and they essentially try to find lots of different approaches. And from what we understand over the past year, that has kind of revived. Who those individuals are, can't be entirely certain, but there certainly are enough people who've had experience with this in the past.
Mm. And don't forget that the World Institute for the Study of the Juche Idea is located in Tokyo. So there may be some people there. Not sure about that. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of this roundtable. Any final thoughts to leave us with, Jongmin?
Well, if you're interested in K-League as well, we have a North Korean athlete who will be
Japan-born
North Korean soccer player who will be playing for Anyang FC.
Right.
Get your ticket,
who has played for the North Korean national team on multiple occasions.
Including against South Korea. Ooh,
exactly.
Interesting. So
that's going to be interesting.
He may be on the field with some former people he was...
Isn't that a breach of the May 25th measures, which prohibits inter-Korean trade?
Well, so here's the thing, though. So even with sanctions,
I kind of feel sorry.
Essentially, it comes down to the fact that so this has happened with North Koreans who have played in South Korea in the past. They essentially are they're all Japanese born, and they were given South Korean passports. So legally, they're South Koreans, so there's no actual...
We need to get someone at Incheon Airport to see what kind of passport this footballer...
I'm sorry, I meant to say May 24th measures. Apologies for getting the date wrong.
Yeah, but so essentially the thing is, a lot of these Zainichi Koreans, the Japan-born, Japanese-born Koreans, they don't have citizenship, Japanese citizenship, yep, in the way ethnic Japanese people do. So mm-hmm. quite often they end up being taking up a South Korean passport at some stage to allow to be able to travel.
For practical interesting purposes, yeah, yeah. Okay, well, thank you once again, Chad O'Carroll, Jongmin Kim, and Shreyas Reddy for joining me on the March podcast. And we will talk to some of you again next month.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Navigating the dynamics of the Korean Peninsula requires more than just information. It demands insight. Korea Risk Group offers strategic consulting that cuts through the noise. Our experts provide in-depth analysis, risk assessments, and bespoke reports, all tailored to your specific needs. Whether you're exploring new opportunities or managing existing challenges, our insights can be your compass. To learn more about how we can help you make informed, strategic decisions, visit careerrisk.com/solutions today. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of our podcast episode for today. Our thanks go to Brian Betts and Alana Hill for facilitating this episode, and to our post-recording producer genius, Gabby Magnuson, who cuts out all the extraneous noises, awkward silences, bodily functions, and fixes the audio levels. Thank you, and listen again next time.